The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
So you are Camilo Gomez. You're the podcaster behind the History and Politics podcast.
Yeah, I am Peruvian. I am based here in Lima, Peru, but for different reasons, I start freelancing for publications that were overseas, particularly American publications. So I started to be more, at least on social media, particularly more writing in English. So I guess at that point, there wasn't many podcasts in Spanish. So when I tried to interview people, I tried to make a podcast in Spanish, but like people were confused when I sent it, like the links, and so things didn't work out. So I created the podcast in English. And actually, the last podcast I recorded was about Bolivia, like the process of change from the election of Evo Morales initially to the coup that take him out, to the more recent election where the movement towards socialism has go back into power. So it was curious that was kind of the last conversation I had, and that in a very small fragment of time, a lot of things were kind of happening this last week and are currently still happening these days.
What's been going on in Peru recently? I guess maybe the place to start is with Kaczynski, who was the president of Peru before Vizcarra.
Yeah.
Would that be the good place to start, or should we start further back?
No, I think Kaczynski is an interesting start. As you mentioned, Kaczynski, whose name is Pedro Pablo, but people know him by his last name, Kaczynski. He is a businessman who has worked in several corporations, and he has always been called a lobbyist. So he was involved and has been always involved in corruption scandals. But what in the end made him resign was that he had signed basically a pact with the Fujimorist of releasing Alberto Fujimori if they were not going to vote in order to oust him, because like there were some investigations around corruption. So the issue is that the Peruvian constitution has a clause that is that the president could be removed by moral incapacity. But the issue is that moral incapacity is, as many constitutionalists of different tendencies have pointed out, moral incapacity is a term that was used historically to describe a mental illness, not something of a wrongdoing for say in some way. So, but with that pressure, and I think having lost any kind of credibility, he resigned, and then Martin Vizcarra assumed power. Kuczynski was a very particular politician, because Kuczynski is white in one of the least white countries in Latin America. I guess only the 10% of the population describes themselves as white. He is far wealthier than even the average politician. He studied overseas. He did his undergraduate degree in Oxford, his master's in Princeton. So he was in many ways very out of touch with the average Peruvian. Meanwhile, Martin Vizcarra was a mestizo politician who has kind of humble origins. He was not from Lima, but from Moquegua, which is a region in the south of Peru. He moved to Lima to study in the National University of Engineering, which I guess will be the equivalent of the MIT in the US. He was and he like has worked as engineer for a while, and then he started in politics. He was a governor on his region, Moquegua. He was fairly successful by Peruvian standards. He like the rankings in education, particularly in the Moquegua region, started to improve under his watch. So he, like PPK, is more or less a centrist, a center-right kind of coalition, but he wanted to give someone that wasn't white in the as part of the coalition, because a lot of the politicians and people linked to his own party, which has the initial of his name, so like PPK, was literally his own party. So he wanted to bring a new face. So he picked Martin Vizcarra as his vice president. And in his years in office, since PPK resigned, I think Vizcarra has become kind of a populist, because he's a centrist. I mean, he's pro-life. He doesn't support drug decriminalization. He's not a radical in any kind of sense, despite that, you know, like the far right calls him a fan of Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez, despite that he's probably the most hawkish on Venezuela. He has been a staunch critic of Maduro. But he is slightly on economics a little bit more moderate than Kuczynski, who as a businessman has a much more kind of numbers, just numbers mentality, and in that sense, like he was much more inclusive, and for that was the reason that he had a lot of support until his recent ousting.
So tell me about the PPK, I guess it's the Peruvians for Change.
Peruvians for Change will mean it was basically a center-right coalition, and I guess among them Vizcarra was the least center-right of them, but he was not center-left. He just was not as orthodox on economic issues as the others. And they tried previously to oust him, but he closed the previous parliament, who was considered fairly corrupt, and called for new elections. But basically, they did the same. When they were they tried to oust him before, but were unsuccessful to reach the number. But last week, in Monday, they were able to do it. They reach 105 votes, and in Peru, in the Peruvian Congress, there is 130 votes. So you need 87 to oust a president, and they technically did it. Although the Constitutional Tribunal was going to pronounce itself this week, in theory, still is going to pronounce itself this week about what is going on and the legality, because many consider that this hasn't been a constitutional process, rather a coup, and that's what many argue.
What's going on right this moment is that Martin Vizcarra has been ousted, and in response, there are massive protests throughout Peru. The man who originally replaced him, Manuel Merino, was himself replaced, and a new president has been selected, Francisco Sagasti. Is that how you would say his name?
Yeah,
right?
Sagasti. Yeah, Francisco Sagasti. See, yeah. I mean,
and he's with the World Bank. He's a former World Bank official.
Yeah, he's also a centrist, but he's a centrist with much more context than than Vizcarra. He's someone who did his PhD in the US. So yeah, he is someone who has someone he's called Don Quixote here. Like, that's his appellative because he's white, tall, and old. He's in his 70s, and I think he's certainly probably one of the most well-read Peruvian politicians. He knows a lot about, has written, I think, many books. And but it is going to be a difficult process because, like, the issue is that the ability to defeat what many have considered a coup was that there were massive protests. So when Manuel Merino emerged as president, like, the police accepted quickly, more or less. The army was more reticent, but it also accepted. But the issue was that there was already from the beginning a kind of sense of illegitimacy. It's true that the same day he was elected, there were very few people in outside of parliament. And as long as, you know, the news got out, a lot of more people started to come in. So I think that was an interesting development. And the days as the days started to pass, like, people were going in larger numbers in the streets. I think at the beginning it was kind of an alliance between the first days, I guess, between what you could call elements of the left, because there are also some elements of the left that in some ways you could say were kind of supportive of the coup in some strange way. But at least some elements of the left, and I think in reality large part of the actual left, not necessarily the left that is in parliament, were kind of initially important. And also, some, I guess, liberals in the American context, I guess the people who call liberals, but then it became much, much bigger. Libertarians, it became like kind of everyone except fascists, because like he tried to name a cabinet that was kind of consensus in some way, but it seemed that the more moderate candidates that to fill the cabinet rejected the call.
I'm going to ask you a very American-centric question here. So in the United States, Donald Trump was called a populist for a while. He kind of thought of as a populist. In comparison to the traditional Republican, he seemed to want to do more social spending, especially around infrastructure, which may have been what distinguished him from a traditional trickle-down kind of Reagan-style Republican here. When COVID-19 hit, Trump was roundly criticized for his response to it. He was thought to have been incompetent. There weren't enough tests. There weren't enough ventilators. The response was poor, and overall, it's been a national. It's kind of a point of embarrassment for the nation as to how many people have gotten sick and how many people have died here. So 250,000 almost now who've died. Vizcarra has also been criticized for his response to COVID-19. And he's also deemed to be something of a populist. He was a center-right candidate who swung a little bit more toward the populist side and abandoned what has come to define the center, I guess, internationally, which is a sort of neoliberal politics. Why is it that he would be embraced by the left as he gets thrown out for under charges of incompetence and corruption? Whereas I can't imagine the left ever embracing Trump. What do you think distinguishes the two? I mean, you seem very much more sympathetic to him than you would be, I assume, for someone like Trump. So Were the accusations about COVID-19 baseless? Were the corruption charges without merit? And why is it that the people, so many people, are kind of identifying with Vizcarra?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. I think we haven't talked about this, but it's true that Peru is one of the countries that has been most affected by COVID-19, not only in Latin America, in the entire world. It has among the highest rates of both infection rates and also death rates. So it is true that there has been, it will be in many ways a failure the way that the Vizcarra has handled this pandemic. But to be honest, even the most competent politician in the world couldn't do that much in the Peruvian context, because Peru is the third more informal economy in the world. So the issue is that many people survive as street vendors, and it is street vending and you know the large wet markets that have been points of infection of higher rates of infection. So it was very difficult. Also, a lot of people lack water, so it's something as that should be as simple as washing your hands once you go home. Is very difficult. And the health infrastructure has been there is a lot of corruption that has been going on, not just from Vizcarra time, but before. So in some ways, I think it could sound strange that Vizcarra has the large number of approval that he has, but it's because like people have the impression that he cares about them, and people have the impression that he is not as far away as other politicians. So in that sense, he took quick measures. Like Peru was one of the first countries in Latin America to impose a lockdown. But sadly, measures weren't successful. As for the accusations of corruption, I think a very serious political scientist who is called Farid Kahat, he's a Peruvian political scientist of Palestinian descent. He has been on several international media like CNN and several others. He's considered among the most well-respected political scientists, not just in Peru, but in Latin America, said that the accusations of corruption has a really strong base. And that, in his opinion, there is a strong possibility that those accusations are true. That being said, his opinion, and I think that was the opinion of many people, was that the elections are next year, and Vizcarra has made all indications that he is not going to leave Peru, that he's going to stay, he's not going to try to escape. So it was kind of the use of corruption to kind of oust him was kind of an attempt of a part of different elements in Congress, but mainly right wing elements in Congress to kind of impose their agenda. So in the Peruvian context is curious, but there are several parties who are led by people who have low quality for profit universities. So, for example, Cesar Acuña, who is the leader of Alliance for Progress, he is the owner of the Cesar Vallejo University. Also, Jose Luna, who is the leader of the Peru We Can, Podemos Peru We Can, is the owner of the Telesub University. Also in the Union for Peru, there is Virgilio Acuña, who actually is the brother of Cesar Acuña, but that he has his own university, which is University Señor de Zipán. Señor de Zipán is the name of an archaeological site in northern Peru. So this kind of it is a lot of interest, the particular, and the prime minister actually was Antero Flores Arauz, was a prime minister in the government of Alan Garcia, and that was heavily questioned by the actions of the police under his watch, that ended up in the massive killings of indigenous people that were protesting in Bawa, in the Amazonas region in the north of Peru. So he was also the lawyer of the Teles of University. So there were that. Also, it seems that there was some kind of involvement of Telefonica, which is a large Spanish telecommunications corporation, because they Vizcarra wanted them to pay, like they haven't been paying taxes, and so it seems that they also were involved, because like the Minister of Transports and Communications were signed some authorized the creation of a new enterprise of Telefonica very quickly. So it's still early to know what was precisely that. But also there was the involvement of two forms of the left that are very different. So the Union for Peru has members of the Etnocáceres, the movement, which is a movement that was led by Antauro Humala, which is the brother of the former president of Peru, Ollantumala. So it is a very curious movement, because it is kind of a left-wing indigenous nationalism, particularly Andean indigenous nationalism. And it has some kind of support between the troops, and particularly between the veterans, people that quit the military. So Antauro Humala tried to did a coup in 2005. He failed to do and is jailed. So one of the policies of Union for Peru was to liberate him, and apparently that was one of the promises that Manuel Merino did, but it's they betrayed him on that. It's a very curious movement, because like the Etnocáceres, it's true that in large part there are kind of a weird mix of Andean indigenous nationalism, of a left-wing flavor, but they have attracted people that have links with the Shining Path, for example, and also Trump fans, local Peruvian Trump fans, which is kind of a weird mix in itself. But yeah, also there is the Frente Amplio, which is a party that tried to be in quote-unquote more pure, but I think that it has shown, you know, a very kind of stupid strategy of trying to oust Vizcarra, because like the Merino was to the right of Vizcarra and the cabinet was fairly to the right of the previous cabinet. And
the party that Vizcarra, you know, was president of, it was a new party, right? Around Kaczynski. How often, I mean, are there strong, traditional, long-standing parties still in Peru? How many parties are there? Is there a lot of fluidity around party formation in Peru?
Yeah, I would say that at this point there are not longer institutional parties, because actually the Popular Action was kind of institutional in some way, but now with Merino, a lot of people have, you know, lost any hope, because Popular Action was the
is this a popular force or popular action?
Popular Action.
Are they, okay.
Yeah, it's the party that led to power. Fernando Belaunde was also kind of a center-right president. So Fernando Belaunde is seen in memory as a kind of institutionalism. In that sense, it kind of some of support. And there was the APRA, but Alan Garcia had accusations of corruption that were very heavy. So it seems that he was going to jail. And when the police tried to capture him, like, he committed suicide. So in that way, I guess like it was kind of the end of the APRA. So the APRA has lost a lot of support, like in kind of in a very rapid way. Popular Force, which is the party of the Fujimorismo, has also lost a lot of force lately. It was curious. As we talk, I mentioned Frente Amplio, but one of the people in Frente Amplio was key on them to enter parliament was Enrique Fernández Chacón, who is a Trotskyist. He was a Trotskyist union leader. And he was very popular. He was very outspoken. He's retired and he's very old, but he was very popular, but he also supported the coup. And now, like, people are canceling him, like, for supporting a coup that many consider had ended up, you know, like, that has the elements of a fascist coup and see them as responsible of many of those. Of the things that have happened in those days, and also there is another party which is very weird, is the FREPAP. So it is very complex to explain it quickly, but they call themselves Israelites, but they aren't Jews in the traditional sense. But Peruvian culture has a very curious relationship with Judaism, because despite that we don't have as many Jews as other countries in Latin America, like Argentina, Brazil, or Mexico. When the Spaniards came, they thought initially the Andean people were Jews for some reason, because it seemed that at least compared to other people in other parts, because it was an empire, it had some forms of organization were more of kind of that reminded of those forms of organization that had the Jewish community and kind of and so there is a lot of relationship that is quite complex to entangle, but the issue is that they basically combine elements of Protestant Christianity with ancient Judaism and what they consider Inca religion. So they are quite of a religious group that is, it is on some economic issues slightly more left-wing than the average party, but on social issues they are quite conservative. So they also supported the coup. But something curious is that Martín Vizcarra is probably one of the few presidents in the world that doesn't have that didn't have any parliament, any congressman. So he didn't have a party, and many say that was his mistake. But I would say that that's the main reason why people support him, because they see him as a part of the political class. And it is very difficult to say that a politician is a part of the political class. But in the case to Vizcarra, I understand kind of the logic to people to see him in that way, because that was Peruvians have a strong distrust in parties, so I guess that was part of his charm.
This popular movement to support Vizcarra, or at least to oppose the new reigning presidents and parties, does it have a basis in the working class? Is there a working class core to it? How do people see this moment in terms of their own demands, their own interests, or when they're going out into the street?
Two of the figures of the protest have been two people from the working class, and one particularly that has been become very popular, Isabel Cortez. She's a cleaning worker. She works cleaning the streets for the municipality, but she was a candidate for the other left-wing coalition that is in the Frente Amplio, that is Together for Peru, that is led by Veronica Mendoza, who curiously was in Bolivia in the ceremony of assumption of Luis Arce, the candidate of the movement towards socialism that day was assumed the presidency. She and Gajela, who is a trans activist. She's of Afro-Indigenous descent, were kind of on the front lines of this fight. And actually the photo of that, you know, a group of the scholars put online supporting the protest of the Peruvian people feature Gajela, who also was a congressional candidate by Together for Peru, being beaten by the police. So so in some ways there were these two women are politicians, but at the same time are politicians of working class background, and it's true that there were working class background to this protest. So this protest happened everywhere. Like it happened in Miraflores, which is I guess probably the most wealthiest neighbor in the district in not only Los Mil Lima but the entire country, and also the San Juan de Lurigancho, which is a very kind of poor that has, but it's more mixed. But even in the poorest parts of that district, but not just in Lima, it was in all parts of Peru. Like it was on the coastal region, on the Andean region, on the Amazon, in large cities, in medium cities, in small cities. So it was kind of a mass movement. Like it was very diverse. Like there were people dressed as the Power Rangers, and in other marches there were women with polleras, which is kind of the traditional indigenous clothing. In some marches there were nuns, and in others were people playing zampoñas, which is an Andean instrument. So it was kind of a massive movement, a kind of a grassroots and decentralized movement that was coordinated, but that particularly in Lima kind of felt like repression in many ways, and it ended up with so the protest started like basically since Manuel Merino was confirmed by the Congress as president, in which many of us consider was a coup in the sense that it was the legality wasn't ruled and a lot of things that considered the issue as a coup. So it was kind of the discourse of a coup that it generated and that make people protest. Some protested in supporting of Vizcarra, some protested because there were they have indignation of the political class that in the middle of this crisis they're going to tear down a government that as even with his limitations and mistakes was doing something. So the repression was particularly important in Lima, and I think in this part there is some elements that we are not completely sure, but it was curious because in a lot of pro Vizcarra rallies the police was already violent even when Vizcarra was president. So in some sense it seems that Vizcarra was never completely in control of the police. It's true that they weren't as violent as now, because now so there were already injuries on the first days of the protest, but in the Saturday, particularly on Saturday night, there were two people dead, and there have been several people injured, and there were more than I think 70 people disappear. So the people disappear sometimes have like the people that have appear later that it became a violent repression because they were tearing tear gas from every part, but even like the helicopters were throwing we're throwing also tear gas from like the skies. So it was like people tried to, so a lot of people just end up, touching, trying to call on the neighbors to enter the home, because like it was full of like tear gases were everywhere. Like but others have appeared in hospitals, and there are still two missing. But the issue that a lot of them have appeared shows that there is a lot of pressure in the police.
Yeah, and Manuel Merino, the former president who just stepped down, I guess, in part, according to the BBC, in response to the protests and the people who died during the protests, that it was thought to be such a volatile situation that he had to step aside after the violent crackdowns on demonstrators.
Yeah, particularly the two young men who died. Jack Ryan Pintado was a student of law at the and the other victim was Inti Sotelo, was a student to be a tourist guide. So they were two young men that died, and I think that moved a lot of people that even to this point were completely sure about that. The thing that was curious is that Saturday, like the chairman of like the CEO of the Peruvian Credit Bank has come out in favor of the protest, which was curious, and it like people was kind of confused, but the protests that the days before had been so massive that I feel that maybe they were feeling that this government wasn't going to last. And it was very curious because a lot of people haven't like pay attention to the role that education has played in this protest. Like people sometimes forget that the oldest university in the Americas is not in the US, but in Peru.
So tell me a little more about what role education has played. Is it mostly educated people who are protesting or young students who are out there?
Yeah, I think in general the protests have been very young, than more young than most protests, mainly because of COVID-19. Because as people know, like for a young person to be infected, it's not as severe generally as someone who is really old. But the issue was that the Vizcarra was a defender of the university reform that included, you know, some statements of quality, and those statements of quality basically closed some universities, including Tel Aviv University and other universities, included the University of Señor de Sipan, who was of the politicians in Congress. So in that sense, the people have an idea of support to education. And I think that one of the first measures that they were going to look around was try to tear down the university reform. And the university reform was highly popular because it was seen as an attempt to improve education in a country that sadly has a very bad system of education. So it was like a lot of even if not institutionally at the start, a lot of faculty were supportive of the protests, and a lot of the people that in the protests were obviously young, many were students, but many were also former students. So the pandemic has hit very badly Peru, and as I mentioned before, Peru is a very informal economy. So many people have actually dropped out, particularly of the private universities. In Peru, public universities are actually free. As I mentioned before, like the oldest university of the Americas is in Peru, like the National University of San Marcos, where I studied, actually. But the issue is that public universities are difficult to get in. I guess the equivalent is that, you know, at least in the large cities, public universities are like the flagship. So, I mean, it will be like if UC Berkeley was free, but, you know, it's still like not everyone is going to get in. So the people that don't get in into a public university, the only way kind of going to universities to go to a private one, and particularly the ones that were on the more cheap side were the ones that have a much lower level of of economic advantage at the end of the degree, because like since the recognition was very small in the labor market, like it, in some cases many end up working on jobs that didn't require actual university education. So I feel that was a huge element that hasn't been as discussed as it should before.
In the United States for a long time, there's been a sense that while a university education does make a difference in terms of your income statistically, that there are still many people who are graduating from college today who don't have real job prospects that, you know, the university degree was supposed to guarantee. That, you know, you graduate from college with a lot of debt here because we don't have free universities, but then you end up, you know, trying to pay that off over a lifetime working kind of dead end minimum wage or low wage jobs. That's not an uncommon story here. Does a university education in Peru still guarantee some sort of middle class existence in Peru? What percentage of the population is getting educated, and how many of the educated young people out there who are protesting now are looking ahead at maybe unemployment or underemployment?
Yeah, I mean, the statistics for this like vary a lot. And I think like some people think that it's not that large as percent of the population as some people may imagine, despite that it's very strong in the rhetoric of universities, because as I have said, like Peru has the oldest university, and actually the goal of many families to move to the cities was other school attend at university, because obviously in Peru there is not the equivalent of you know, like I don't know how to call it, a community college or you know, like even in, or liberal arts college that are, you know, are in small towns. So basically the universities are all in large towns. So the statistics vary a lot in the sense that you know, some argue like that there is a 20% of people that finish high school that go to university. Others say that the number is larger. But the issue is that a lot of universities are informal and you know, haven't have the recognition. So sometimes it's difficult to measure the universities that aren't licensed, and in theory has to close with the universities that are licensed and that should continue to exist. So the numbers are kind of vary according to different researchers. But in general, the idea of that, you know, university education can guarantee you a kind of decent middle class life is kind of going away. I think that if someone studies engineer in a relatively high ranking university here, it still is going to do well, because like Peru has a lot of, Peru has a very important mining industry, for example. Peru is the second producer of copper in the world. It has the sixth reserves of gold, and it is a country where their mining is, so mining engineer, you know, like things like that are, you know, like careers that have a more or less secure path, and also civil engineer, because there is a lot of constructions going on, but. Two of the professions that were kind of very common because it didn't require many maths, you know, were law, which here in Peru is an undergraduate degree, and journalism. But there are a lot of, you know, people with those degrees now, so the possibilities to enter the market are much more difficult now. So it is kind of a complex moment for the youth, in particular because the COVID-19 has hit very hard the Peruvian economy, so it's kind of a difficult moment.
So where do you? How many people are out protesting overall right now? Are there good numbers on that? And where do you think the protests are going to be going next? Is there going to be a political movement apart from Vizcarra that builds out of this, or is the goal to get him back into office, or where do you see this going?
Yeah, I mean, I do not think that – I think that there are some staunch Vizcarra supporters. I do think some of the people still marching want to march because, like, we don't want the Manuel Merino is not found. It's some suspect that he might try to leave the country and to ask for diplomatic asylum of some sort. And another of the politicians involved in the coup also are considered to maybe going to ask asylum. So the protests are kind of against the impunity of the violence that end up with the life of these two young men, with many people injured and still with two people missing. So there are going to be some protests that are more for that, against impunity. There are going to be some protests that are for a new constitution. I guess, and like the Constitutional Tribunal, in theory, has to pronounce this week, but I honestly doubt that they are going to reinstall Vizcarra. And I guess Vizcarra will continue his he has a judicial process that he has to present himself. So he at least is going to continue in that process, trying to defend himself. But what I will say about all of this is that it was for me very surprising, like how the international left was very silent. So neither AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, have said a word. Not a lot of the publications, of left wing publications, and it's pretty sad. It's true. I'm astounded.
What do you think accounts for that reluctance?
It is curious. I think that there is a tendency, for the left to see the American empire behind everything. But I think this kind of development was kind of much more local in many ways. You know, it kind of a Peruvian strain of reactionary politics. But I'm very critical of NGOs and a lot of human rights organizations that sometimes seem very bureaucratic, but they were quick in point out these abuses. Also, the Washington Post, even the New York Times this time has been more accurate. The Guardian, a lot of media were international media, not necessarily left wing, but international media had been, even the Wall Street Journal of all people were kind of supportive of the protest, which I really like when the Wall Street Journal was saying this seems like an illegitimate government and the protests have a reason. Like, I was like, wait a minute, like something is going on.
Yeah, what is it though? What is going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a very curious combination. I mean, like it was a very kind of new reactionary politics that tried to mix different things. So that, I think, could explain it. So in some ways, they wanted to take some populist measures, like they wanted to make people able to retire, to take the money for their retirements, which many argue will bankrupt the pension system. Also, that people don't pay the debts to the banks, with many people argue was going to make crisis to the financial system. So in that sense, in some ways, maybe, like, as I say, Peru is a country that has large mines that, particular copper and gold. So in some of even like people that may not be left wing in any way, it might be like dangerous for them put a government that could lead to economic instability of materials who are needed for kind of the global capitalist system in some way.
Do you think that Francisco Sagasti is going to survive as the new president for a while, or do you think he'll be stepping aside next week or in the next couple of days, or how do you think things are going to be going?
Yeah, I think he's going to survive for a while. As I said, I think you know, a lot of people are looking for him to try to reform things a little bit more. But I also think it was kind of a very intense week. Like Peru has seen not that much before. A lot of people say that the Peru has been fall for apathy and it, yeah, like a lot of curious developments. I mean, it was very curious. A lot of people point out very quickly that, for example, like the a lot of particularly women influencers, you know, that work for international brands of, you know, cosmetics, things like that, you know, were very quickly to put BLM like in their bios. But, you know, like there were repressing people here in Peru, like they didn't say anything. So some people argue that showed the lack of support of you know, of that kind of corporations have, you know, kind of a PR in some way that it's not necessarily representative of that deep of politics. I mean, what is more disconcerting is that even the Latin American left was quite silent, which it was kind of a much disturbing issue. The thing that is true is that a lot of governments didn't recognize the president. And the most curious thing is that a right-wing government like the president of Salvador called him dictator, was the first to call him dictator, when not even like you know, Luis Arce, which technically is in a socialist organization.
It's first to call who a dictator? I'm sorry, I lost the thread.
Bukele was the president of El Salvador. Call Merino a dictator the day of
okay, the, just want to make sure. Yeah, not Fiscara, yeah. But Merino, right? Okay.
Yeah, it was very curious.
How long was Merino even in power for? Like a couple of days or less than a week, right?
Yeah, less than a week. It's true. I mean, it was a movement very that was massive, and I think it shows. I think that, you know, like some people said, you know, that it will be good if AOC is the future of the Democratic Party. But I will say that in foreign policy, if AOC is the future of the Democratic Party, the Democratic Party is going to look a lot more like the Democratic Party of the past that what some people will hope in the future. I mean, like in not to try to go to our topic, but in Kyrgyzstan, like the police were also shooting people in the protests against the electoral fraud. But not that I, you know, understand that much that, but in that sense, I guess like it's true that, you know, Central Asian politics are much more complex and a lot of people don't know Russian, much less Kyrgyz. So. But in the case of Latin America, like AOC speaks Spanish. I guess there are people in DSA who speak Spanish. So it was not, you know, like impossible to try to make a comprehension that the forces behind the coup were reactionary. So, yeah, that really surprised me.
Would you say that the new president and the fact that he's been installed means that the coup has already failed?
In some ways, I feel that it has, and I think it has in some ways worked against reactionary force, because now the police is worried, like because like the international press went and they take pictures, so it is going to be very complex for the police to escape this case, and I think it's going to affect them in a way that it was much bigger than they expected, so. Without a police that could be, you know, very repressive in the future, like I don't think there is I don't think reactionary politics have, a very strong base in Peru. Like the Popular Force, which right wing has, you know, what people sometimes call the solid base of the Popular base is 10%. The Popular force is 10%. So it's not, you know, a huge chunk of the Peruvian population. Peruvians are a very curious mix, which in some ways reminds me of populations of other parts of the Andes. Because in some ways, we have kind of this is what some people call free market instincts, because like obviously, like a lot of the economy being informal, like people are not anti-market, in at least in rhetoric. But at the same time, I think that obviously there is a call for having, you know, a government, not necessarily larger, but that covers some things. For example, like the public healthcare system is really a tragedy. Like it has been like collapsing for a while. I mean, there are hospitals that literally fall apart. I mean, it's a very a very complex situation, and I think the corruption is something that Peruvians really want to move away from politics, because like it's true that Vizcarra had allegations of corruption, so 68 of the members of Congress.